get called to order.
It's on?
Okay. The Senate Committee on Public Safety Budget Division is called to order. Today is the 22nd, I think. Okay, we're going to stop for just a second here. There's a reason for having water in a bottle. Let's try that over again. The Committee on Public Safety Budget Division has called to order. It's January 22nd, 2007. We have overviews on from three of the departments that are part of our budget today. And we're going to start out with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you so much, Senator Higgins. I very much appreciate the opportunity to be here to address you in the committee. I'm Isabel Gomez, the director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission for the last 10 months or so. And I want to make the point, first of all, that I will be happy to speak with any legislator at any time about any sentencing issue, individually, in groups, or whatever you like. Today I'm going to talk as fast as I can, hoping to get to your questions, which we'll be able to answer today or to get back to you on. I want to start with some background. In the 1970s, it was universally recognized that indeterminate sentencing was broken. And by indeterminate sentencing, I mean sentencing in which the actual time that an offender will serve is not known when he enters prison, because it is determined at some point in time by a corrections board or a parole board, in contrast with determinate sentences, which we have in Minnesota, in which on the day of sentencing, the time that the offender will serve is known. Now, there were concerns about public safety, a sense that people couldn't know for sure that dangerous offenders would be out of circulation for any specific time. There was concern with the sort of backdoor decisions that are involved with corrections boards or parole boards. These officials are not elected. The boards are highly political. They're subject to bias, particularly to racial bias, and they're never usually required to explain their decisions. If they do give explanations, those decisions are not reviewable, so it doesn't matter how good or bad the decisions are. Similar offenders were getting really seriously disparate sentences. It was entirely possible and recorded that you might have, for example, two robbers in adjacent cells, one of whom with similar criminal histories, one of whom did 18 months and another did 18 years. That, of course, all added up to disproportionate punishment as well. There's a notorious Supreme Court case in the 70s in which a California flasher who had done 25 years in prison appealed to the United States Supreme Court. That was at a time when rapists in California were getting 3 years. The only explanation that could be gleaned for why that had occurred was that he was unable to convince the corrections board that he was rehabilitated, and the Supreme Court felt that it did not have the authority to do anything about that situation. Very importantly, in an indeterminate system, you can't do forecasting or prediction, and therefore it becomes well-nigh impossible to manage prison populations, and the result is often dangerously overcrowded prisons, which may lead to court orders to reduce the populations, and then no ability to sort out who you've got so as to make rational decisions about who gets out. This is a problem that California has today. They're looking at the fact that they, despite a spate of prison building, have hugely overcrowded their prisons. They're waiting for federal orders from judges to empty the prisons, and they have no idea how they're going to go about empty them because they have no idea who they have. Some states then are still caught up in these problems, but Minnesota, in that way that we Minnesotans can be proud of, came up with a solution. And that was the sentencing guidelines, the first in the nation, which were implemented in 1980. The guidelines are certainly not perfect, but they are admired throughout the United States and truly throughout the world. That is not an exaggeration. Minnesotans, I know, have worked with officials in the former Soviet republics, in Africa and in China, concerning rational punishment for crime. I personally have briefed the Congressional Judiciary Committee staffs concerning guidelines, and have spoken since last March with officials in Maine, Vermont, and in South Africa about the possibility of guidelines being implemented in those jurisdictions. I've been invited by Stanford University to attend 8 meetings over 2 years concerning what might be done concerning California's problems. And that's not because I'm so brilliant. It's because I know the guidelines and because, to some extent, I was a frog in the laboratory, if you will, and actually used the guidelines when I worked as a judge. The technicalities of how the guidelines operate are set out in our annual report to the legislature, which you've all received. I want to focus on the bigger picture of, you know, what it is that the guidelines give us. Overall, sentencing in Minnesota is supposed to protect public safety. Now, surely what that means is reducing the likelihood that any given Minnesotan will be victimized. We are in the end game. You know, there are all kinds of ways you might avoid or reduce crime at the front end. The Sentencing Commission is working at the back end. We're in the intensive care business, if you will. It's a little bit like trying to cure AIDS through intensive care. Our ability to impact folks is greatly reduced in the end game. There are two ways at this point that we can reduce crime if we're doing a decent job. One is incapacitation, and that means taking the most dangerous offenders out of circulation for long enough times to protect the public from them. I think it's clear that Minnesota is doing a good job in that area based on a significant reduction in sex offenses over the years and our consistently low homicide rates. Then there is, more important, the matter of reducing recidivism, because virtually everyone we send to prison or into the system does get out. And that is best achieved by basing policy on facts. In the 21st century, at last, we have a wonderful opportunity really to do research and use research to inform our policy. In Minnesota, we have not taken leadership in this area at all. But it is good news that our corrections people, those particularly who supervise probationers, are really on evidence-based practices and looking to improve our system in that way. That also ties into those issues that you've all been interested in about reentry. Now, what the guidelines give us in these terms, or in addressing these issues, is first of all proportionality. We have graduated punishments with the most serious offenses getting the most serious sentences. Secondly, we avoid disparities in the sentences of like offenders. People who do similar crimes and have similar criminal histories get similar sentences. We have been able, to a much greater extent than almost any state, to use our resources rationally by directing money toward the offenders who most need to be incapacitated because they present the highest risk to reoffend. I can't overemphasize how important it is that we are able to predict prison bed impact and to track our population so that we know exactly who's been convicted of felonies and where they are. We take that for granted in Minnesota. We've been doing it now for 25 years. Most jurisdictions can't do it at all. And to the extent they do track or try to predict prison populations, they don't do it too well because they don't have the database that we do to build on. This is hugely valuable and can't be overemphasized. Finally, and this is very important, we have sentencing that is transparent and is certain, and those things are essential to protect public safety and particularly to give victims the rights that the state has determined they're entitled to. What a determinate sentence means for a victim is that on the day of sentencing, he or she can go in, hear the sentence, and know exactly when the person who harmed them is getting out of prison. Otherwise, if you have an indeterminate sentence or a situation, what you have is a victim who is never quite able to close the door because they have to be waiting to see when this person's coming up for review and be willing to testify sometimes over and over again concerning the appropriateness of that person's release. This is tremendously important. Now, the structure of the commission is that we have 11 Minnesotans who are the commissioners. Three of them are appointed by the Chief Justice, their judges, and eight of them are appointed by the governor. They include the Commissioner of Corrections, representatives of the public defender, county attorneys, probation officers, peace officers, and citizens. Of the citizens, one must be a victim. And our current chair is Sheriff Steve Borchardt of Olmsted County. He's a wonderful chair. We're very fortunate in him. The day-to-day work of the commission is done in the office by a staff of 5.75, including me. And this year, in 2006 fiscal, that staff processed nearly 20,000 felony sentences, in contrast with 1981, when the commission began and processed about 5,500 sentences. What are the staff's duties? Very, very importantly, to maintain a database which is a state treasure. We have been entering the details of every felony sentenced in Minnesota since 1981 into this database. It is by far the richest database of felony information in the United States, which probably means the world because we sentence a lot more people in the United States. And how would we use it? Well, first of all, some of you know that whenever there is a proposal for a bill in the legislature involving crime or crime policy, the commission does what's called a fiscal note, which is a prediction of how that bill, if it were enacted, would impact state resources, prison resources. Again, I've told you, we have the ability to track exactly how many we have of any kind of criminal you might wish to know about, that turns out to be useful in a whole lot of ways. And I'm not going to get into that because it's a little technical, but it's very important to know who you've got. We can tell how our judges and prosecutors are handling any kind of crime that you might want to look at. The commission publishes yearly statistical data about many aspects of crime in Minnesota. Those are all, the 2005 data is all on our website. We have summary statistics for all felony offenders in 2005. We have controlled substance offenses, criminal vehicular homicide and injury, criminal sexual conduct, offenses involving firearms, failure to register, et cetera, et cetera. Those statistics are all available on our website, and I can provide hard copies to anyone who wants those. Now, what I want to say, this data bank, which I certainly did not appreciate until I got the job I have, is like the gold lode in the western United States before the 49ers got there. It is a huge wealth. It is unmined. And unlike the gold, when you mine it, it gets richer. If you mine it, it doesn't go away. It gets better. And it is particularly important in the 21st century when we can mine it effectively. To understand that a very small investment in resources up front can get out data that really is of incalculable value in basing as a basis for sound public policy for the spending of corrections money, of which there is a tremendous amount spent every year. The commission has decided that we should use the database for a racial disparity research project, which will be the first of its kind in the country and the most detailed. Right now, it is 9 times likelier that an African-American man will go to prison than that a white man will in Minnesota. Until the meth bump, it was 12 times likelier that a black man would. And we've never really drilled down to understand what that's about. At the very least, we have to know what part of that disparity is rational, that is based on real differences in how people behave. And what part of it is not rational, that may be resulting from certain policies or practices within the system. I have gotten together a collaborative with the University of Law School, with the Supreme Court research, Hennepin County District Court and Corrections Research. We've got a research plan, and I have now been given permission to seek private funding for the research. We're not trying to ask you for that money. Because for a lot of reasons. But at any rate, wish me luck. Second thing, besides the data, the staff maintains the guidelines by changing them in response to changes in the law and case law. Thirdly, we do training. We trained last year 500 lawyers, probation officers, and judges to use the guidelines. Every day, there are at least 2 people on the phone in the office answering questions from practitioners about particular cases, and they get the answers instantly, or maybe, in rare cases, within a couple of hours. We get data requests from all sorts of people, official, unofficial, civilian, whatever. And in the past, all of those data requests have been answered. We no longer are able to answer many of the data requests. I have been doing a very painful kind of triage based on whether or not we've got any capacity in the office on a particular week to do anything additional, and whether or not the information that's being requested is being actually used in some concrete fashion that's important. We've got a bunch of slides here. I'm going to quick run through these, and mostly, they're designed to give you a sense of what we've got and also to raise a few questions. The first slide, and I think you have copies of these in your handouts, is offenders sentenced for felony convictions between 81 and 2005. And what you can see is that in that length of time, there has been an increase of 181% in the number of felony sentences. In the next slide, we see a change in prison populations. The change in prison populations, which is always upward as well, is based on, first of all, this increased volume of cases, but also a higher imprisonment rate, in which more people are going to prison, although that is not such a huge change either. But very importantly, sentence duration. There are a lot of the people who go are getting longer sentences than they did in the past. And this next slide, percentage changes across populations. What that does is to stack up population, number of felons sentenced, prison population, and crime rate to show you how they change over the years. And what it shows, really, is that there's no correlation, particularly among or between statistics about how many people are sentenced and imprisoned on the one hand and actual changes in the population or the crime rate on the other. For example, our prison population has increased 288% over that time span since 1990. Our population's increased 23%, and our crime rate has declined. Senator Foley, did you have a question?
I guess he did. Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Judge Gomez, one of the concerns I have is the data. Is that reflect those individuals that are in county jails, or is this only in state penal institutions?
Sadly, in state the number of felony sentences is everybody, whether they're in the jail or in the prison. I've got, if we skip a couple of slides from now, I'll get into that just a little more. Right now, the commission has never been ordered or enabled to do measurement of day of jail. And you will see that because Minnesota uses jail much, 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 much more than any jurisdiction, we're a real outlier. I think there's a serious issue about the usefulness of fiscal notes that leave out the local data, and we can come back to that. I really think that ought to be done. We'd figure out how to collect some data that we don't have at present and that is not being systematically collected. The jail data is a mess. It's very hard to make any sense of it at all. But it could be, certainly could be done, and one hopes that it will be done. We've got a slide here about the number of sex offenses, which shows that we have fewer now than we did in 1989. And if you look at the whole thing, I'm thinking that maybe we've got some incapacitation right there in those offenders, because surely between 1990 and now, people have become more likely to report, if anything, and yet we have a declining number of offenders. So we may actually have been having some success in identifying who needs to be locked up and getting them locked up. Then we have, next slide, prison population by offense type. What you want would be in that red box for that to be the majority of cases. Those are the person offenses. You can see we've drifted away from that over the years, and that the non-person offense component of our prison population has increased substantially. The next slide shows another bite of the same data. And what it shows is that this year, or rather in 2005, only 49% of the people in our state prisons were there for person offenses. Everybody else was there for drugs or DUI or property offenses or something other than person offenses. That presents some policy questions which the legislature might want to look at. Next area, probation revocations. This is also very important. I want to emphasize that we're concerned about the accuracy of our 2004-05 data. We think that perhaps that's a little high. Still, though, the basic trend is the same. The reason we think it's a little high is we were using DOC data for that, and it doesn't track with our data, and we like ours better now. But at any rate, what we're seeing there is the number of people who go on probation and violate probation, not because they commit a new felony, but because they were unsuccessful on probation. And there is no way that that change over time can be good news, because it represents a tremendous amount of failure. And in all of those cases, what we're doing is spending the money on probation and then spending it on prison. And that does not sound too like a good idea. The next slide shows the net result. Senator Lance?
Madam Chair, Judge, if I might ask about the last slide.
Yep.
Is there any way to determine if the probation failures is a result of increased violations of probation versus a change in the oversight practices or the likelihood of violating probationers where an infraction might not have been acted upon in the past, but it is more likely to be acted upon now?
We certainly could and should find that out. Do we know? No. And that is going to be a big part of the race research, obviously. I mean, we need to know what's going on there. And if you look at the fallout, so the answer is we should know that, but we have not done research on that, we being the state. This next slide shows where we end up in 2005. 39% of the people who are going to prison in Minnesota in 2005 had committed a felony. All of the rest of them, 61%, had either violated probation or violated supervised release. These figures are astonishing in national terms. They're the only jurisdiction that sort of gets up there is California, and nobody else is anywhere near this kind of picture. And again, as Senator Latz seems to be, the kinds of questions Senator Latz raises are exactly the kinds of questions that need to be raised, separated out by gender in the next slide. And then the next one, this goes to Senator Foley's concern. Here we see total incarceration rates in Minnesota of felony offenders. We're talking about looking at the folks who committed felonies, how many of them get locked up either in jail or prison? And the answer is more in Minnesota than in any state in the United States. We use cells much more in Minnesota than anywhere else. But the biggest, so we're kind of ahead of the pack there, and that might not be bad. I mean, I don't know. But again, we should know what is going on there. And the part that is particularly interesting there, you will see that the orange line at the bottom is the prison proportion of felons who go to prison. That's gone up a little, but not so much. If you look at the jail population, the red line, however, that's gone steadily upward. And if we look at simply the jail rate compared with other states, there is no state that is anywhere near Minnesota in terms of the amount of local jail space that's being used for felons. Again, that may be bad, that may be good, I don't know. But it certainly shows that we need to be able to predict jail impact just as we can predict prison impact. Surely it is as important that local authorities, county authorities, be able to know what's coming and that we be able to manage county facilities as to manage state facilities. We've been pretty successful at state facilities. I suspect we could be successful at jail facilities, too. And you all know that we haven't been so great at that. A lot of communities have been faced with overcrowding, having to build new jails, being surprised by the jail population. And probably everybody is smarting at the cost. We did bring a handout which just gives you some local jail statistics because we know everybody's interested in that.
Judge Gomez, Senator Ingebrigtsen has a question.
Okay, sorry, I missed that, Senator.
Madam Chair, question with the chart that you have before you there with the line staying somewhat the same for prison population where the counties are going up. My question to you is, and maybe it has nothing to do with it, does a short-term offender situation that the state has gotten into with the county over the last couple of years have something to do with that possibly?
It might have something to do with it, but not enough to it doesn't get at two things. First of all, the total rate at which we use cells, which makes me wonder, you know, if we're not one-trick ponies. I mean, we've really kind of gotten into locking people up, and maybe we haven't been sufficiently creative about other possibilities. I don't know. And although the short-term offenders tend to, I'd have to get back to you. I want to double-check this because I'm not sure whether they get counted, you know, which way they get counted. Could we get back to you on that? Thank you very much. All of the rest of the slides are related to drugs. I'm not going to go through them one by one. We have an updated drug report, which we hope to have in your hands by the middle of February. We will have in your hands by the middle of February, and that would provide a better context for discussion of drug issues than the slides. The slides, however, make a couple of really interesting points. One is the sheer number of drug offenders, and the other is the sheer number of departures in drug cases. We have a lot of drug cases, an increasing number of felony drug cases, and really startling departure rates. Even for meth manufacture, only half the people who are presumed prison commits actually end up there. What this suggests is that practitioners, county attorneys, prosecutors, judges, are seeing these sentences that are the presumed sentences as being too long. You all need to decide or might want to decide whether they're right or wrong about that. The commission has a strong sense of what I would call comity about this. Our drug report will have some scenarios, some suggestions, and some indication of what they might, what costs they might reduce if they were implemented. But the commission has not wanted to come up with something you know, with changes in the guidelines unilaterally, because these are very important issues, and they're issues we think best decided by elected officials representing your communities. And what we would like to do is to offer you assistance in terms of research and data that might assist you in making some decisions, and also to give you some possible ways to approach the issue if you should want to. But as I say, out of respect for your roles compared to ours, we have not come up with something like the sex offender grid where we feel strongly we ought to do this or that. And, of course, actually we did that at your request as well. So that's the end of my statements.
Thank you. Questions? Judge Gomez, I have a question. In all of that information there, what can you tell us about recidivism? Recidivism rates?
Well,
you know, do they tend to be parole? You know, just what kind of information is there that
we do not have? We have not mined that data to get at recidivism. The Department of Corrections has recently done a recidivism report, and I take no position as to whether that report is accurate or not, because I have not been able to sit down with a researcher on our staff to go over with it. Recidivism research is extremely tricky. There are 900 ways that you can look at it, 900 places you can measure it. You have to be careful that you're talking about apples and apples. And so I'm afraid that however much time I had, I could not get back to you with anything good on recidivism. I think that we need, you know, I would like to look at the DLC stuff and see what we make of it.
Okay. Senator Foley?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Gomez, do you have with you any grids that some of these folks aren't dealing with crime and punishment, and would be helpful if they were to look at a grid and you could tell them how they get into various places?
You know, I didn't bring them. I thought about bringing them, but they are in the, as I said, they are in the report to the legislature. And I will be more than happy to come around and talk with anyone individually who wants to get a sense of how that operates. Basically, what the grid does is look at two factors concerning each felony. One is the seriousness of the felony. The other is the offender's criminal history. And the grid consists of, along the long side, offenses ranked in terms of their seriousness, and across the top side, criminal history scores. And at the intersection is a presumed sentence. All of that, the rankings, the computation of criminal history scores, and the presumed sentences are based on Minnesota practices over the years and also on legislative decisions about what policy should be. I think it's important to emphasize that the guideline structure is neutral. It can hold or capture whatever policy the legislature wants. I mean, if you want shorter sentences, you can have shorter sentences. If you want longer, you can have whatever. And I think I'm concerned about that because sometimes there seems to be some confusion about the guideline structure itself requiring a certain length of sentence or harshness of sentence or something, which it does not. That is the stuff that's inside that structure comes from public discussion and legislative decisions and Supreme Court and Court of Appeals decisions.
Judge Gomez, the presumed sentence that you talked about when the grids intersect, is that a hard and fast number of months, or is that a range?
Thank you, Senator Higgins. That's a really important point. In the prison, some of these cases are presumed non-prison cases where the person is presumed to be appropriate for probation. Those are usually a fixed sentence. in the prison commits, there's a range. And the commission recently enlarged the range so that judges are able to go down or up farther without doing what are called departures, a very important part of the guidelines scheme. And a thing that makes it so appealing in other states is that there is a provision for judges not to impose the guideline sentence if they see that there are substantial and compelling reasons why this offender is different or why this case is different, and if they can articulate what those reasons are. So they are able to say, this is the presumed sentence. I don't want to, this person should not go to prison because this offense was not as serious as the typical offense. Or this person should go to prison, but the sentence is too long. Frankly, in 22 years as a judge, I never, in Hennepin County, where I don't even know how many hundreds of people I sentenced in 22 years, I never had a day, honestly, where I thought I couldn't give us the sentence that this person ought to have. Because I think the scheme allows that if you are thoughtful and clear and coherent about what you're doing and why. And frankly, I have not found lawyers or judges particularly limited in their ability to rationalize departures. But thank you so much for asking that one.
You're welcome. Other questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We look forward to working with you.
Likewise. Thank you, Senator Higgins. And we'll get back.
Okay, our next presenter is going to talk about the post board. Mr. Melton. There you are.
Does it matter which microphone I use?
Whichever you prefer.
See, it's warm.
Yeah, that one's all warmed up. There's information in your packets, members, about the post board.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Neil Melton, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training. It's commonly called the Post Board. Also in your possession should be a four-page handout packet, and we will go through that in just a few minutes, and I will do my best to be brief. To those of you new to the Senate, you may not have ever heard of the Minnesota Post Board. It's one of the state's best-kept secrets. We may be small, but we are vital. My brief comments will consist of two components. First, a review of the factual who and what of issues relating to the post board. And then secondly, a few words on the how and the why of the board's role in state government. The post board was created by legislation in 1977, and Minnesota was the first state in the nation to do so. As part of that enabling legislation, they also crafted the mission of the post board, and that is to enhance the profession of law enforcement in Minnesota through the selection, education, licensing, and regulation of peace officers. So in that vein, the state has a vested interest in guaranteeing law enforcement is professional and consistent, whether you're in Ada or at Zumbrota, Minnesota, for agencies large and small, rural and urban, agencies with considerable resources, and agencies with very limited resources. All citizens, regardless of where they live within the state, deserve the very best public safety services we can provide. On your first handout page, the post board's key service components. These are the specific functions the board performs in partnerships with the law enforcement agencies, colleges and universities, the legislature, the governor's office, community groups, individual citizens. And on this sheet of key service components, I really think the verbs tell the story. Go through some of these briefly. The Post Board manages an occupational licensing program. We create a licensing exam. We develop and maintain learning objectives for the colleges and universities. We certify professional peace officer education programs in those colleges. We approve law enforcement continuing education. We monitor compliance of the continuing education requirements for peace officers. We administer a training reimbursement fund to assist law enforcement agencies. More on that a little later. We establish and we enforce minimum selection standards and standards of conduct for peace officers. We oversee that law enforcement agencies are in compliance with mandated policies and procedures. We promulgate administrative rules. We monitor board-specific and law enforcement-related activities that come out of the legislature. We provide technical assistance to colleges and universities. We participate in numerous meetings, conferences, task force, etc. We respond to many questions and requests for information from citizens, the television media, the print media. We answer constituent questions, and we perform other services as mandated by the legislature. The second page of the handout packet reflects the post-board constituent groups. In other words, these are the stakeholders. But the citizens of Minnesota, certainly the governor's office, the legislature, 475 law enforcement agencies, state, county, and local. Currently, there are over 10,000 active peace officers, 1,200 inactive, 310 active part-timers, 106 inactive part-timers. We also spend a great deal of time working with the professional law enforcement organizations, the Chiefs Association, the Sheriffs, the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, State Patrol, Conservation, the Association of Women Police, and many other agency-specific federations and so forth. Also, we work closely with higher education, and that is specifically the 22 colleges and universities that offer all or part of what is called the Professional Peace Officer Education Program. In Minnesota, to be a peace officer, you need at least a two-year college degree. These 22 colleges reflect two-year and four-year schools, both public and private. We also deal with other state agencies and other government-related agencies, such as the League of Minnesota Cities, Association of Minnesota Counties, the Association of Townships. A lot of work with special interest in community groups, as well as the media. As I mentioned, we reflect 475 agencies in Minnesota. Currently, there are 365 local police departments, 87 sheriffs, 9 non-municipal police departments, that's like the university and Metro Transit and so forth. There are 8 tribal police departments, as well as 6 state agencies. The agencies range in size from one officer to 828. Interestingly enough, 10% of those agencies in Minnesota have only one officer. 10% have one officer. 40% have 7 or fewer. Now, 7 is sort of the magic number for an agency to be able to provide 24-hour coverage 7 days a week. 40% have 7 or fewer officers. And only 15 agencies in the state have more than 100. Those figures showcase a challenge the Post Board faces. Number one, how to be both a regulator and a resource to such a diverse group of law enforcement agencies. And to be honest, a similar challenge faces you as well. Legislation is a broad brush. Therefore, statutes enacted will apply equally to all agencies, whether they have one officer or 800. As I mentioned earlier, there are currently 475 agencies in the state, but that number could change by the end of today. The concept of policing in Minnesota is evolving. Since 1990, nearly 100 law enforcement agencies across the state have consolidated, contracted for service, or simply disbanded. The transition from local police departments to regional agencies is a fascinating study and one that the Post Board will monitor closely in the future. We work with the agencies that are considering consolidating, disbanding, or contracting to ensure that their citizens are still well protected. Third page in the handout packet is the Post Board membership. The 15-member Post Board, the members are appointed by the governor to 4-year staggered terms. And the board membership is stated in statute with very specific positions. For example, one of them is the superintendent of the BCA. That's the only ex officio member. Whoever occupies that seat is a board member. We have 2 police chiefs, 2 sheriffs, four peace officers, one of whom must be a state trooper, two former peace officers who are now faculty members in the colleges, one college administrator, two public members, and lastly, my favorite category, one elected official from a community outside the metro area with a population of less than 5,000. Very specific what they wanted. Also, that list of 15 represents my collective boss. The fourth page of the handout is very interesting. It talks about the funding source for the Post Board. The Post Board is funded solely through a special revenue account from a court surcharge on certain criminal and traffic offenses. You can consider it as a rather an odd user fee. The Post Board's operating budget and the money it reimburses to local units of government for training costs are funded exclusively through that account. There are no direct taxpayer dollars. The fund currently generates about $16 million a year, and the authorized distribution percentages are shown in the shaded block on the handout. 1% goes to the DNR Game and Fish Fund, 39% to Post, but not to exceed the legislative appropriation, and 60% is allocated to the general fund. A closer look at the percentages reveals that the 39% is actually a maximum authorized by statute. Our budget is set by you, and since 2002, the authorized 39% has been really between 27 and 22%. Of what Post does receive from the legislature, over 75% of that money is returned to local units of government, law enforcement agencies, in the form of reimbursements for police training. And I call your attention to the bottom of handout page number 4 for the table of figures. In the right-hand column, as you can see, the per officer reimbursement share has decreased since 2003 and is roughly 76% of what it was in 1989. That's 18 years ago. While training costs have certainly increased, the reimbursement dollars have not.
Just a second, please. Senator Foley has a question.
What I'm missing is the sheets that he's talking from. Yeah, I don't have that.
We will get you one. Okay, there we go.
Boom.
Proceed, please.
The per officer share represents money sent directly to your law enforcement agencies in your districts and has a direct bearing on the amount of training your officers receive. Now, before I close, allow me to share some thoughts about POST. As a police licensing and regulatory board, we serve a unique public function. One of the basic functions of state government is to regulate the practices of various professions. The goal of regulation has always been to protect the health and welfare of the citizens. And underlying that responsibility is the belief that regulation improves the level of service. And I believe that's happened in the 30 years POST has been in existence. While the POST Board's regulatory component is straightforward, it's just a responsibility based on statute and rule, it's our resource component that really takes creative thought. We partner with law enforcement to fulfill the legislative, administrative, rule directives. We are an ever-evolving agency intent on searching for new and innovative ways to improve law enforcement in Minnesota. The Post Board strives to assist Minnesota's law enforcement community to better serve and protect the people who live in, work in, or merely visit this great state. Madam Chair, it's a summary of my presentation. I am happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Ingebretson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some questions. Mr. Milton, do you oversee the tribal police in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebretson, yes, we have purview over the tribes that are currently enrolled with us, not the sovereign nations of Red Lake and Boys Fort.
So they would receive, Madam Chair, question
Senator
again.
Ingebretson.
Follow-up question, they would be receiving, those that are with you obviously receive an officer reimbursement then.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Mr. Milton, I'm curious about the upcoming GOP convention. Will you be having a role to play in training people to deal with the masses of folks who are coming?
Aside from being on vacation that week, no, we're going to be
smart.
We do not train, Madam Chair. What we do is approve training. And I've been in contact with not only the Commissioner of Public Safety and Chief Harrington from St. Paul PD. They're going to need a lot of officers. And we already have in statute authorization for officers from adjoining states to come in and work in Minnesota under the direct supervision of a Minnesota-licensed peace officer. So we think there'll be some components there. But as they get closer to the convention, and I believe it's former FBI agent Pierce is spearheading that, we'll keep the discussions going. But we've provided all the information we can about number of licensees, how they can get them from adjoining states, and so forth.
Okay. Keep us posted on how that's going as well. I think that would be interesting to know.
I will, Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Yes, Madam Chair and Mr. Melder. I've got a bill that deals with administrative process. I note that a substantial portion of your revenue comes from traffic and felony and gross misdemeanor type violations, that there's a surcharge on each one of those. Are you aware of how many agencies in the state of Minnesota are subverting the legislative action and going the administrative route, if you will?
Mr. Melton?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, no, a specific number, I am not. The Post Board is aware that this legislation has been circulating for a while. We will discuss it at our board meeting Thursday.
Questions? Mr. Melton, I have one more question. In the governor's proposal this morning, he proposes that any increase in local government aid be directly for public safety. And I know that it takes a long time to get a police officer trained and hired. Do we have the training capacity for the large cities that would be looking for for more police through that expanded LGA, if it happens?
Madam Chair, to be clear, are you asking about pre-service education, that leads them up to the licensing exam, or is it continuing education after they've been hired?
Pre.
Right. The capacity of the colleges, again, I mentioned there are 22 colleges and universities that offer all or part of it. They're graduating about 1,100 candidates per year. And those are the candidates that sit for our licensing exam. Of those, last year we awarded licenses to 614, and I believe it was 580 the year before. So the capacity is there. I think it becomes a point of, do the agencies want a specific type of candidate that they may want to get into the programs? I know I've had these conversations with Chief Harrington and Chief Dolan and Colonel Danaski from the State Patrol, looking for specific things. But the colleges can well provide over 1,000 graduates per year.
What's the typical amount of training that an individual police force would have after college?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it really depends. You come out of the college, you pass the licensing exam, you are not a peace officer. You are eligible to be. You need to be hired. Then, depending on the agency, some of them send them to some very comprehensive and lengthy field training. State Patrol might be 15 weeks. St. Paul might be 12 to 15 weeks, that they do very specific in-house training. Other agencies, like my former agency, Bloomington Police, they put you through a 15 to 16-week field training. You're on the street. You're not in a classroom anymore, but you're actually on the street. Some agencies that have fewer resources, fewer personnel, they're looking for almost turnkey officers. That is someone who came out of school, passed the exam. Here are the city limits. Be safe out there. So the training runs the gamut from very minimal to very extensive.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Melton, I was wondering about the cooperation or the ability to find out if there's any federal monies and how that affects the post training, such as COPS, the COPS monies. Are you directly affiliated with any of that federal money that comes through?
Madam Chair, Mr. Senator Rosen, no. Again, we are not training providers. Our role is very specific, that we approve training. There are a number of local agencies, police department, sheriff's department, state agencies, that go out and seek the grants to promote an individual training concept. For example, years ago, it was racial profiling. We did a lot of that. Then it was pursuit training. And we've had a number of these issues come up over the years, but the funding is usually not coming from us. The money may be put through us, through our budgets, and we're accountable for the reimbursement, so to speak.
Thank you. All right. Thank you so much.
Chair,
we'll be
thank you.
Talking to you about your actual budget somewhere in the next few weeks.
Look forward to it, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. The third department to talk to us today is the Department of Human Rights. And I think Commissioner Corbel is here. Sorry. Members, while the computer is getting set up, you'll notice on your agenda the upcoming events include a tour of the BCA on Wednesday during our committee time. And I think you all got an email, or your LA got an email, asking if you would let Ms. Seufert know if you're going to be on that tour, if you want to get carpooling arranged or anything like that. Ms. Seufert can be useful in that work as well. You'll be back here by the end of the regular committee hour. It's not far away, so if you wanted to drive yourself, that works too. There should be plenty of parking there if you'd prefer that. And then on Friday, we're going to go tour Stillwater and Oak Park Heights, and we'd also like to know who's going on that tour. That's a tour with the House, like the tour we had today that Senator Ingebretson and I went on over to morning arraignments at Ramsey County. I know I got a lot out of it. Senator Ingebretson, it's not quite like your jail.
No, that's for sure.
It really is a state-of-the-art facility.
Yeah,
it was really interesting to see. And one of the things I enjoyed the most about it was that the prosecutor in the courtroom that we were working on was Representative John Lesh. So I think we scared him half to death when he turned around and saw a bunch of his colleagues sitting there. But I know I've already gotten a lot out of the tours that we've done, and I'm hoping that you'll find the ones that we've put together useful. So I hope you'll join us on these tours, and just let Alice know, and we'll get them all set. Commissioner, whenever you're ready, go ahead and start.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing me to visit today. Happy New Year. It's good to see you. I haven't seen you in a while. I am here today just to provide the committee with an overview of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. My name is Velma Corbell. I'm the commissioner at the Department of Human Rights, and I have with me today two of my executive team leaders. They're the ones that spend the most time talking to the legislature, one on the budget and one on any policy initiatives that come up during the session. The first is my deputy commissioner, James Kirkpatrick, who's here today.
Welcome.
James does most of the interaction with the legislature on budget initiatives. And then Linda Hansen is our director of policy and legal affairs, and Linda spends time talking to the legislature about policy initiatives that come up during the course of the session.
Welcome to you both.
I think I went one too far, but the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is a department, small state agency that has been around since the mid-50s and actually obtained its status as a department in 1967. The mission of the department, as you'll see from your second slide, is we are in the business to make Minnesota discrimination-free. Some of our key program activities on the third slide in your handout, our three key functional areas are enforcement, compliance, and education. And in the enforcement area, that's the area of work that most people in the state are familiar with, and that's where we take in charges of discrimination and either investigate them or send them over to our alternative dispute resolution program so that those charges can be resolved. In our compliance area, most people who are familiar with that understand that that's the work involved with taking in and reviewing affirmative action plans of state contractors. In addition to reviewing the plans, we also issue what's called a certificate of compliance to those businesses so that when they're bidding on state contracts, there is a record of their having an approved affirmative action plan on file with our department. We also conduct compliance reviews on businesses doing business with the state of Minnesota. And I have information a little bit later in the presentation that talks about the volume of that work. And as part of our compliance program, we also provide training and technical assistance to those contractors who have certificates of compliance or who have approved affirmative action plans. And about 3 years ago, we did get the approval from the legislature to charge a small amount of money as compensation for reviewing and approving those plans, which is part of our ongoing budget at this point. We also have a voluntary certificate programs, and believe it or not, there are companies in the state of Minnesota who seek us out and want to have that affirmative action plan on file. And I think what they know that it does is provide them an opportunity to have policies and procedures reviewed. It's also an opportunity to have a free advisor available to them to talk to about things that might be happening in their work environments that they might not be well versed on, but we have people at the department who can help with that. We also have a blossoming education and outreach program. Some of the key components of that, we do an annual human rights conference every December. It's held every first Friday in December during Human Rights Week in commemoration of the signing of the Declaration of International Human Rights. We have a very extensive electronic newsletter on our website. I'm told that it's one of the best newsletters from a state agency in the state, and the website also is, I think, very well done. It provides a lot of good information to folks who go to the site. We provide community activities around the state of Minnesota. We try to do at least four community forums each year and at 2 to 3 training showcases. And the difference is in those two things. The community forums are where we go out to different communities in the state of Minnesota, primarily rural Minnesota, because they don't really have access to the department as well as folk in the urban areas. We invite a panel of experts to talk about human rights-related topics, things that are relevant to that particular community, and we always have folks from the Department of Human Rights there to answer questions about the community's rights and obligations under the law relative to the topic that we are discussing at that forum. Our training showcases are very popular, and those are also technical assistance types of activities where we bring in trainers, usually labor attorneys and others who can train on a variety of topics. And we choose topics such as the disability provisions of the Human Rights Act, sexual harassment, the role of a manager in preventing discrimination. And we take those showcases to different communities in the state of Minnesota and provide training to businesses and employers, service providers, and a plethora of industries so that the managers in those organizations understand what their obligations are in preventing discrimination and complying with the Human Rights Act. The one thing that I that is the goal of the showcase is that when a manager, and they're usually high-level managers who are attending the showcases, it's our expectation that at some point in the future, that manager will go back and talk to the rest of the folk in their organization and bring that training back to their organization. And at a minimum, they understand what they don't know about the Human Rights Act so that they can call in their own attorney or someone there locally who can provide them some training on the law. And the thing that is sort of at a springboard right now, kind of a stepping off point, is our education partnerships with kindergarten through 12th grade schools and also with higher education. And I'll talk a little bit more about that, too, a little bit later in the presentation. This is a rendition of actually a pocket-sized card that we provide to people in the state. It's called the Are You Protected card, and what it depicts are the areas and bases of coverage under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. There are 8 areas of protection and 13 protected classes, and those protected classes are race, color, creed, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, disability, public assistance, age, sexual orientation, familial status, and activity on a local human rights commission. And across the top, you'll see the areas of protection. And not all the bases are jurisdictional in all areas, but the dots on the chart will indicate where we have jurisdiction. Employment, housing, public accommodations, public service, education, credit, business, and reprisal. In our enforcement area, I have provided a pie chart that shows just the comparison of how the charges come in by area. You'll notice that the employment area is the largest, where we receive the greatest number of charges, roughly 83%, and the rest in those other areas. If you look at the charges that came in fiscal year 2006 by basis, the disability line looks like the largest one, and we do find that as the population ages, as people are more familiar with the disability law, there is a significant number of disability complaints that come into the department. But if you look at race and national origin as a composite, that race and national origin still is the leader in terms of the basis where charges come into the department, and then along that continuum. If you want to look at at all of the achievements, or some of the key achievements in the enforcement area in fiscal year 2006, just a rundown of some of the numbers, we received roughly 12,000 inquiries, either through email, walk-ins, attorney-drafted charges, various ways that people make contact with the department. Not everything that comes into the department, of course, is jurisdictional, so we do tend to make a lot of referrals to other agencies and other organizations where we can. We evaluated about 6,000 jurisdictional complaints, and those actually resulted in a questionnaire being completed and sent to a potential charging party so that they can take a look at that, and within a certain amount of time, based on the statute, they get that back to us if they want to continue with their charge. From that 6,000 jurisdictional complaints evaluated, we actually filed a little over 1,000 charges. In our ADR, 56 mediations conducted, 163 administrative appeals from charging parties and or respondents who believe that there was something overlooked or not investigated in their case, so we handled about 163 of those. 86% of the cases completed in 180 days. We have a statutory requirement that we complete non-complex cases within 6 months, and so we are completing about 86 of all of our charges, complex and non-complex, within about 180 days. $1.2 million recovered for charging parties. None of this money comes back to the department. It all goes to charging parties or charging parties' attorney. Very rarely does anything come back to the department in terms of covering cost. $276,000 generated for the general fund as a result of the work share agreement that we have with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And what the work share agreement
Excuse
is.
Me, Commissioner?
Yes.
Just a sec. Senator Latz has
yes.
a question.
Senator
Thank
Latz.
Chair Higgins, Commissioner Approximately what proportion of the charges that you determine do you find in favor of the charging party, and what proportion are in favor of the responding party?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, roughly 10% of the charges that come into the department result in what's called a probable cause determination. But what we find, I think, that's probably a higher percentage in favor of settling in favor of the charging party is when things go to alternative dispute resolution. Because if you consider the amount of charges that do result in that no probable cause determination, many of those charges that go to ADR probably would end up being an NPC determination. But because we are sending charges to ADR where there's a tenant still in a landlord's property, or if there's an employer that's still in an employment situation and we're trying to create a win-win situation and have things resolved as efficiently and effectively as possible, when respondents and charging parties voluntarily enter into that mediation process, I think then that provides, I think, more value to a charging party because it resolves that kind of peaceably for both sides.
Commissioner, of those that do get probable cause determinations or findings, probable cause or no probable cause, do you have some idea of what the proportions are?
We do know what the proportions are. As a matter of fact, I have a copy of the legislative report that I can recite some numbers for you from. Any particular area that you're interested in?
Senator Latz.
Chair Higgins, Commissioner, I would say that, well, the probably the most frequent subjects of charging: disability, race, sex, age, national orientation, and national origin and sexual orientation, those top ones.
Commissioner?
If we go back to the chart that talked about the charges by area and basis, you saw that in terms of basis, it was disability and race and national origin that were the top ones. So that follows that trend, that the majority of the cases where we find probable cause determination are in those areas: race, national origin, and in disability.
I'm sorry, maybe I'm not being clear on my question, Commissioner, but let's take, for example, disability. Of all of the disability charges which you receive and for which you make a determination, probable cause or no probable cause, what proportion do you find there is probable cause?
About 5%.
Okay. And are the about for race and national origin?
It's about the same across the board.
That's consistent. So about 5% of the ones that go to decision, you find probable cause?
About 5% of all of the charges that are investigated result in a probable cause determination.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
In our compliance area, I've got a couple of pie charts here that show the number of compliance reviews that are conducted in Greater Minnesota versus in the metro area. That's a 7-county metro area. And of the certificates of compliance issued, the metro area versus the Greater Minnesota area. And we have roughly 2,000 certificate holders in our database at any one time. And we'll talk a little bit later about some of the compliance achievements. In fiscal year 2006, there were approximately 100 compliance reviews conducted, and you will see that it's fairly balanced, and I think the reason, well, I know the reason that there are more reviews conducted in the metro area, more certificates issued in the metro area. Number one is because there are more businesses here, and number two, particularly when it comes to compliance reviews, it just costs money to travel and stay overnight and do some of those things. And so we try to limit the numbers of reviews that we do in Greater Minnesota to the ones that have the larger dollar amount state contracts, because those are the ones that have the most potential to hire and retain women and people of color. Some of the compliance accomplishments in FY 2006: 1,500 certified contractors, 786 total certified in 2006, 24 suspensions. What this means is if there are state contract or contractors who are attempting to do business with the state, and they don't have an approved affirmative action plan on file, and they fail to get one in a required amount of time after many attempts, that we can suspend that certificate, and then what that does is really bars a business from doing any business with the state until they have that, until they have their plan renewed. 3,000 plus consultations, and again, 99 compliance reviews. And one of the things too that we've attempted to do over time, back up at the top of the slide, is really move our focus from just a compliance review and then correction at a state contractor site to really review correction, really educating so that whatever has happened on a site that's caused us to really take a close look at them if something has happened there, is to educate them so that that doesn't happen again, and spending time with them to prevent the possibility that any sort of violation to the Human Rights Act would occur. And then I mentioned our voluntary certificate program earlier, where businesses that don't have a contract with the state do seek us out to get that certificate because they do realize the value and the benefit of doing so. In our education and outreach area, as I mentioned, our the Human Rights Day Conference, the forums, the training showcases, various presentations and events. We do video documentaries on various topics and our quarterly newsletter. This overhead just talks about some of the numbers of people that we reach directly through the work that we do. And one of the things that's not on this is we also have what's called a commissioner column that once a month we pick a topic that is relevant at that time, and we do send that column to various newspapers and other publications across the state. And those papers do have an option to pick that up, run it if or not, but there are a fair number of papers around Minnesota, particularly in rural Minnesota, that run that column as a matter of course. And so that reach is that circulation of that particular publication. And so we believe we're reaching a fair number of people over and above what's indicated on this slide. Some other achievements by our education and outreach function in FY 2006 is that our website, through a partnership with the Community Technology Empowerment Project and AmeriCorps, we have been able to translate significant portions of our website into Spanish, Hmong, and Somali. We, for the first time in a decade, were able to interact with the public at this most recent state fair. And we did that through a partnership with other federal and state and local human rights organizations, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, Minneapolis and St. Paul, Human Rights, Civil Rights Offices, St. Cloud, Duluth, Housing and Urban Development. We have a very good working relationship and partnership with the local human rights commissions in the state. As a matter of fact, they are our first contact when we are going into a community to host a forum or a showcase. Human Rights Day, a couple of years ago, we were fortunate enough to receive a grant from the Otto Bremmer Foundation where we were able to put together the toolkit that's talked about in the last bullet, which is a kit of curriculum that's actually downloadable from the internet that's available to every school in the state of Minnesota. In partnership with the University of Minnesota Human Rights Center. And part of that whole, launching of that initiative was in partnership with the Minnesota Twins. They hosted a Human Rights Day at the ballpark in last August. And, again, the toolkit called This Is My Home so far has been circulated in all 342 school districts, and 467 schools have been registered to receive the information from the website. This is a little bit of information about the department at a glance. We have a $6.98 million biennial budget. That won't change that much. The request won't change that much in the next biennium, the budget cycle that we're currently in. 45.1 full-time equivalencies. There are about 50 bodies in the department. Some are part-time and job shares. some other fast facts about the department. In terms of the way the budget is distributed across the organization, about 72% of it is for work in the enforcement area, 18% of it is spent in the compliance area, and 10% is spent in education and outreach. It's significant that the majority of our budget, and I suppose you could expect that in the kind of business that we're in, because it's very labor intensive, particularly when you have investigators and trainers and those kinds of folks. But 88.5% of our budget is in labor cost, and then that is expected to increase rather dramatically to 91.5% to the end of the next biennium without some sort of compensation adjustment. So the biggest portions of our budget are labor and rent. The rent right now is about $20,000 a year, and that's about $6.50 a square foot. So we are, I think, running fairly lean and mean at the department. We have we do a strategic planning process in our department, and every August I take the leadership to a planning retreat, and we talk about the kinds of things that we want to do for the employees. We talk about the reach that we want to have in the state. We talk about different kinds of ways to achieve our mission of making Minnesota discrimination-free, and we always have as the centerpiece of our conversations the six values that you see on the screen before you. And we are their efficiency, fairness, quality, respect, service, and timeliness. And I suppose at the top of the list is always service, because one of the things that I've tried to communicate, and the leadership staff can attest to this, is that I'm a driver of service in the department. At every end of any transaction that we do, whether it's a charge that's been filed, whether it's training that needs to be delivered, there's always another person on the end of that. And as public servants, we need to be ever cognizant of that fact. And so service is probably the top one of those values for me. But the rest, for the most part, are pretty equal in importance. And service, you know, enthusiastically performing the duties, our duties for the people of the state. Fairness, we apply the Human Rights Act consistently and ethically. We follow the rules without favoritism, self-interest, or bias. Quality, we strive to deliver results that are distinguished by superior attention to detail and unrivaled execution. Respect, we exhibit behavior that exemplifies consideration and appreciation of all who are touched by the work of the department. We talked about our service, service value, and then timeliness. We respond to requests and schedule work at a pace and at an interval that epitomizes the optimal customer service. This is just a picture of, the next slide is a picture of the organization chart at a very high level. In addition to the three key areas, enforcement, compliance, and our education and outreach, which is our special programs block, we also have a facilities and administrative services division. Those are the key functional areas. The individuals who lead those areas, there's a director at the head of each one of those, and the numbers of FTEs that each one has responsibility for management and for supervision. Going forward, in the next 4 years, and I'm very pleased to have been invited by the governor to remain for another 4 years, but going forward in 2007 to 2010, we really have three primary strategic initiatives that I've communicated to the leadership, and it's their job to communicate that down to the people that they supervise. We really want to extend our outreach to the public in terms of educating them about their rights and obligations under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. We want to develop our staff so that they are the best in the business. We want them to be the best investigators, the best trainers, the best service providers that they can be. And so we can only do that by making sure they have the skills and the tools necessary to do that. And then we also have an acquisition and implementation technology initiative. We have a database or a case management system that, case management system is really reaching in terms of calling it that, but it's about 10 years old. It needs to be upgraded, and so we have an initiative going forward to try to improve our technology to provide better access to the public, but also to provide a more effective way for staff to interact with the data that we collect in the department, and to have that be recoverable in the event of a disaster, because right now most of our things are in paper, and if something happened, there's really no way to recover or retrieve all of that. And that is a very high-level overview of the department, and I am I will entertain any questions.
Thank you very much. Senator Moore.
thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, let me ask a couple of clarifying questions. The any businesses who want to do business with the state of Minnesota has to come in and file an affirmative action plan, right?
Chair, Madam Chair, Senator Moore, they don't have to come in and file a plan. Most of the documents used to put together an affirmative action plan are downloadable from our website. We can mail the information to them. But there's a very the procedure is very well delineated in terms of what it takes to put together an affirmative action plan. And a business with 40 or more employees over a 12-month period, and if the contract, they're bidding on a contract of $100,000 or more, then they must have an affirmative action plan. So there's a threshold. Not every business, but the ones with the larger number of employees and those larger dollar amounts.
So they, Madam Chair, Commissioner, they have to have that plan, and they get a certificate from the Department of Human Rights saying that they have a plan in place?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, that is correct.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, so do they, when they bid for projects with the state, are you aware if the certificates are made part of the bidding process or the contracting process?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, yes, they are made part of the project package. If they don't have that certificate of compliance at the time of bid, they're not eligible to bid on the project. So they have to have that certificate of compliance prior to bidding if they want to bid on that contract.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, thank you. Commissioner, so for companies that, for example, I've heard lots about companies that come in to have contracts with the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and how there's been some concerns about a lack of disadvantaged business participation in some of those contracts. If that's the case, then why or how is it that, say, MnDOT is able to provide variances in terms of these different contractors' ability to meet what I would think their affirmative action obligations? Is there a discrepancy from what MnDOT is able to do and what you as the Department of Human Rights oversees?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, these are two different programs, a couple different programs you're talking about. The Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program or the Small Business Enterprise Program that is overseen by MnDOT and several other agencies, Met Council, County, those are purchasing programs. And the criteria for those programs have to do with size of the business, not size of the contract, but size of the business and who has control of the business. And by control, I mean 51% or more of the business has to be in control of a woman or a minority, a recognized minority. Size of the business, it depends on what the program that you're referring to. Some it's $50,000, some it's $250,000 net worth companies. What we do at the Department of Human Rights is an affirmative action program for the employment of women and minorities. So we're just looking at the labor part of the deal, not the purchasing part of it. So they're two different programs.
Thank you. Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I'd have to say I've tracked the Department of Human Rights since its inception, and I'm very pleased with the way that you've handled that, and thank you very much for your presentation.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, thank you very much. I appreciate the compliment.
Commissioner, sometime in the fairly recent past, the NAACP sued the Department of Corrections over employment practices. Were you the investigative agency on that?
Madam Chair, no, we weren't. I vaguely recall something of that nature, but we were not the investigator.
Would it have been appropriate for you to be involved?
Madam Chair, it depends. And I know that sounds like a very political answer, but I'm not trying to be. It depends on the nature of the charge. If it was something related to discriminatory employment that's jurisdictional under the Human Rights Act, that would have been something that may have been jurisdictional had they filed with us. But one of the things that we don't do is handle charges that are one organization against another organization. So if the NAACP filed as an organization, that's not something that would have been jurisdictional for us.
Okay. Another question I had, some of us on the committee went down to morning arraignments at Ramsey County this morning, and one of the comments that was made was how the effects of people speaking various languages other than, you know, who the prosecutor or those than the prosecutor or the defender speak, you know, the effect on the person who's being charged would be. Do you have any thoughts about how we could do that better? What are you seeing in your department? Are you seeing a lot of complaints at the corrections or at the judicial level?
Madam Chair, we don't see a large number of charges from those departments or agencies relative to the language being spoken in those proceedings, nor do we receive a lot of national origin complaints related to the treatment in those venues. But what we do at the department is we have hired Spanish language staff, and we have individuals in the department who speak a Hmong dialect, a couple of different dialects. And we also have access to interpreters via state contract. So when we have charging parties that want to file charges with the department, we are available to assist them. One of the other things that we're doing in the department, I mentioned that our website being translated to the three language, Hmong, Spanish, and Somali, but we also have Spanish language folk who can go out into a community and talk to them about the Human Rights Act and what their rights are under the law. And we have just started a conversation with the neighborhood house in over on the east side of St. Paul to do more of that outreach, particularly to these newer communities who don't really have a good knowledge of the law, of the existence of the law. And so in order to outreach to them, we're just trying to create partnerships where we can.
I think my last question has to do with the mediation services and alternative dispute resolution. I think the number was about 55 or 56 of about 1,000 charged cases. Is it possible for that number to increase? I would have thought that there would have been more mediation in your department. How does that all work?
Madam Chair, we have an objective in our department to send at least half of the cases that come into the department to our alternative dispute resolution program. And by that, I simply mean that they're referred from the screening process and during the investigative chain over to the mediation program. Now, once they get there, understand that the mediation program is all voluntary. So we can invite a charging party and a respondent in a charge to mediation, but they both have to agree to want to mediate before they come there. So the number of mediations that we handle really is a factor of the charging party and the respondent both wanting to do it at the same time. One of the things, though, that we have done, recognizing that we wanted to get the numbers up, because I do think it creates a more a less adversarial resolution to a charge, is we are running a pilot program in the department now with we were fortunate to be able to get an intern in to act as a case developer. And really what that means is, because the department really is very deliberate about not tainting a case when it's in mediation, because there's a likelihood that it'll come back to investigation. So we've intentionally tried to build a wall between the investigation and the mediation. The case developer role is one that's very unique, because it's an opportunity to talk more with the potential with the charging party and with the respondent about what the mediation process is. It's an opportunity to really understand what their expectations are of the process, so they don't come into the mediation with dollar amounts in their head that are so disjointed that you can never hope to settle. So we are just right now in the process of running a little pilot project to see how we can change that number, and hopefully we'll have some good outcomes.
Okay, thank you, Senator Latz.
Chair Higgins, Commissioner, if I understand correctly, then you say you get about 6,000 complaints that you evaluate, and you try to refer half of those over to ADR. Am I using the wrong numbers here?
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, let me just go through the list of numbers. We get about 11,000 contacts into the department every year. That could be walk-ins. It could be on a variety of things, some jurisdictional, some not. From that 11 or 12,000 or so, we kind of winnow that down based on whether or not they're jurisdictional to about 6,000 jurisdictional charges. We then write a questionnaire and send it out to the charging party for them to review whether or not we've got the facts straight, as they've alleged, to have them get that signed and notarized and get that back to the department. That's about 6,000. A lot of charging parties fail to return the questionnaire to the department. So from about $6,000, then that gets winnowed down again to about 1,000. So the department really only handles about 1,000 charges a year, 500 to 600 every 6 months. And then of that 500 to 600, only about 300 or so of them ever go over to the mediation process. The charging party and the respondent get invited to mediation. Most oftentimes, as you can tell from the number, they say no. One or both say no. And when they do that, we don't put any pressure on them to mediate. Again, it's all voluntary. There is, though, occasionally during the investigation process, particularly for charges that have been in the mediation process early on and haven't settled, there are rare occasions when a charge will settle during the investigation process, because the respondent and charging party who were engaged in a mediation process very early in the process realize, as we go through the course of the investigation, well, this might have been, this mediation thing at the beginning might have been the best way to get this settled. And so sometimes they do settle predetermination.
Senator Latz.
So, Chair Higgins, Commissioner, you made reference to your report to the state or to the legislature, in which you said there were more details of the numbers. Does that contain breakdowns, for example, say 5% of the disability charges that you determined were found to have probable cause, but maybe 10% of the national origin charges were found to have probable cause? Is that kind of detail available there?
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, no, it does not include that sort of breakdown. The legislative report that we submit to the leadership in there are four committees that we send the report to committee heads and to the legislative library. But the report really responds to a requirement that came out of a 1997 legislative audit. And it really is concerned mainly with how quickly we can get charges determined, because for those who were in the legislature at the time, probably recall that there was a significant backlog in the department at the time. And so the legislature was concerned about getting those charges through the department more quickly and providing some legislative oversight for that. So it really doesn't look to the breakdown of charges so much as that they're determined within the 365-day timeline. But if you would like that information, I'm certain that we could certainly go to the database and get that for you.
Thank Senator Letts.
Chair Higgins, I would appreciate that. Thank you, Commissioner.
Great. Any other questions? Well, we look forward to working with you on your budget in upcoming weeks. Thank you very much for coming to talk to us today.
Very much. It was a pleasure.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? If not, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much. Here's that.